Jean, I hope that you realize that the following letter concerning your work has not been born from the urge for reciprocity, collusion, antagonism, or seduction. I do not set out to be sarcastic, which must be unbelievable for those who read more of my work, because believe me, whenever I apply humor, I am at my utmost seriousness. For some time now, I consider your work as providing an edge of reality, though I must say that I feel more affinity with Roland Barthes' direct ways of expressing himself. Barthes has always given me the feeling of a soul figure who battled the generality of language, though his view lacked somewhat of a social dynamics, which probably was part of his isolated life. He did never comply or compromise with the status of language. As such, he must have come close to real time, as you call it, as his inevitable conclusion was that writing oneself is as simple as the idea of suicide. And he believed in the uncompromised right to speech as the free expression of the individual thinking, linking it with those extreme points in which the body gives itself up for nothing. Both ideas of suicide and sacrifice seem to be prevailing nowadays in the idea of otherness, even of radical otherness, and they are undeniably linked with the right to individual expression in quite a negative way, as you mentioned. There can be a right to speech only if speech is defined as the free expression of an individual, where speech is conceived as a form of implying reciprocity, collusion, antagonism, or seduction, the notion of right can have no possible meaning. And quite obviously I agree with you, but only partly. The trouble is that the notions of implying reciprocity, collusion, antagonism, or seductions are the means by which the motives behind individual expression fall categorized. And as such, by the means of these motives exactly, the free expression of the individual is denied. The catch here is that this motive can be determined by the listener as much as by the speaker. Here I would like to refer to Steven Tyler, who pointed out that the egonomy of both position as the speaker of Descartes contrasted by the hearer of Merleau-Ponty. Both position pertain a certain amount of passivity, which for me seems rather devastating for both individual expression as well as otherness. As opposed on what you want or not, and how you approach the other, but there's hardly any active engagement involved in the idea of reflection, as the relation remains rather sterile for both the self and the other. For instance, suppose I would want to give my body for nothing in this age of capitalism, there would be a slight chance of actually being believed, right to free expression or not. Worse, any free individual expression is likely to lead into harsh accusations about motive, means, and opportunity. And in all honesty, there is a matter of survival which rather implicates one has the right to individual expression, but behold, affecting that right is toying with your life. Of course, this is not all theory, and I hold a similar view as you towards the relationship between theory and reality, as you have expressed to Lothringer. In my opinion, theory is simply a challenge to the real. But I am rather fascinated by the real for different reasons. Your ideal of the real is quite clear, I think, as you explained it again to Lothringer. Reality remains an unshakable postulate towards which you can maintain a relationship, either of adversity or of reconciliation. The real, all things considered, perhaps it exists, not it doesn't exist, is the unsurmountable limit of theory. The real is not an objective status of things. It is the point at which theory can do nothing. In short, reality is that which cannot be revealed by theory, quite logically, as theory is passive and individuals are active. It is true that the other seems to have been eradicated from an or incorporated in Western discourse, but most of them others do not seem very impressed by the fact. I would rather like to view the consequences of this eradication for the rights of individual bodies for free perception and expression within the Western discourse. And as such, I am afraid the individual body is the other we have been toying with all along. The entire discussion on self and other has left the Western Hemisphere because of dint repetition of the sense of concerning rationality, now called justification, then called passion, desire, sexuality, compassion, class, then body, then soul, then mind, you name it, it has been called it. For what theory implies most of all is pacification of individuals by creating passive category for active things. I'm not really afraid, hear me well. In itself, I couldn't care less for categories. After a while, they become rather dull unless they have something to offer. But with Barthes, I think that they are rather suffocating, dwindling my activity as a human being, preventing me to freely communicate, as they imply every free or even temporal communication is basically a form of betrayal of intimacy, or at least that what we believe intimacy to be. Like I said, there's something else about the real that interests me, and that is real time. I have always desired to dwell in real time, but after reading your work, again I arrived at the conclusion that real time must be a very dangerous space to dwell, if at all it does contain any space. It seems that the necessity to perceive one's body in its own space is a censorious illusion, which maintains itself only on account of the inadequacy to perceive real time. Rousseau hinted towards this illusion of time by proclaiming language to be the means of distinction between one person and another, a means originally created to escape each other's environment. Herder went a little bit further in believing that the unity of the sensorium implicated such brightness of simultaneous sense impression that it would be impossible for people to communicate without any kind of reduction of these sense impressions. But nobody has been ever more explicit about it than you, for you proclaim... It's a good thing we ourselves do not live in real time. What would we be in real time? We would be identified at each moment exactly with ourselves, a torment equivalent that of the eternal daylight, a kind of epilepsy of presence, epilepsy of identity, autism, madness, no more absence from oneself, no more distance from others. In seeking out its object, the world seems to have turned us upside down. Maybe one of the greatest evolutionary strokes of genius might be our illusionary perceptibility. Nature left only traces of dinosaurs whose extinction is still magical. The Chernobyl power plant made trees literally grow their branches into the ground and their roots into the air. So why not turn us humans upside down? The possibility we should know by now exists, and indeed reality is a bitch. Real time, you imply, exists. I'm very happy about it. Why? Well, if real time exists, there is always a possibility that some people on this earth will be touched by it. In terms of mystery, maybe the vortex opens once a while to give us a glimpse of the other universe, and again, I'm not being sarcastic here. If a number of scientists would actually suffer a collapse of established sensorium once in a while, in the form of epilepsy of presence and identity, they might actually understand how maddening and autistic they have been operating in the past. To put it bluntly, autism is not a deviation found in those people Bruno Bettelheim once studied. Instead, it is a normality in rational beliefs establishing the illusion of insensitivity. It pleads that animals are Pavlovian conditionees, children have no established personalities, and women are hysterical. Neither of these categories have any actual normal sensitivity. Being conditioned for pain, unaware of existence, or plain crazy, what they have in common is seemingly the absence of true feelings. True or not, what seems to be the case here is in reality, not illusion, an absence of desire, of the motive to gain more accurate. You seem to try to objectify this absence of desire by feminizing it, or, as you explained to Lodringer again, I consider woman the absence of desire. It is of little import whether or not this corresponds to real woman. It is my conception of femininity. For me, femininity is nonpolar. Contrary to masculinity, woman has no anxious vocalization on sex. She can transform herself into herself. Oh my God, what a wonderful idea. But I would like to take it one step further, and because this absence of desire backs the conclusion that femininity does not seek power or control. If one desires nothing, then first of all, there's nothing left to be desired, neither to be controlled. The principle seems pure on the one hand, but allows for the illusion of power on the other hand. One might say that this femininity principle creates a vacuum of power, which is seductive because it traps the masculine in the abundance of the reality principle for the sake of an illusionary reality as we know it. Such an illusion of control over the senses, unfortunately, can only maintain its illusion as long as this femininity principle is maintained as a category of inferior status. Hence, power relations are always established on the basis of the illusionary sensed, those who desire power, and the illusionary unsensed, those who do not desire power. And as such, the sensed need to replace the unsensed through establishing what can be sensed or not. And whatever cannot be sensed is inferior. Of course, all this is a simulacrum for its reversed truth. It is the unsensed who are sensible and the sensed who have lost their senses. Both coexist simultaneously. Now, there is a rather curious twist within this illusion which establishes a social hierarchy in which, like it or not, it produces oppression in a rather deliberate way. To be truly honest about it, I believe that the sensed are very much aware of this illusion and that it's being manipulated beyond the point of recognition, in the literal sense of the word recognizance. For you start out to explain. The objective illusion is the physical fact that in this universe no things coexist in real time, not sex's star, this glass, this table, or myself and all that surround me, by the fact that the dispersal of the relative speed of light, all things exist only in the recorded version, in an unutterable disorder of time scales, at an unscapable distance from each other. Curious, this would imply that all communication has one end in mind, which is to turn this inescapable distance around into an equally inescapable proximity. Indeed, maybe this is what we do in waging war or getting married or taking photographs, etc. For then, communication signifies that a certain amount of holding hostage, as the light caught in the light bulb, or the idea on paper. Indeed, neither does it matter anymore whether this is called love or hate, good or evil. In fact, proximity means the collapse of those oppositions previously created, the difference by establishing those illusionary oppositions which equally create the illusion of the difference. The fact remains that such an illusion of difference and opposition does create a replacement of real sensitivity with artificial insensitive creatures, creatures which remain indifferent and are therefore living at the mercy of their displacement from real time into the confinement of illusionary recognition. And as such, illusionary recognition is the time as we believe it to be, an extremely conservative time, the time of Ferdinand de Saussure and Erik Gans. To replace the sensitive creatures by an insensitive project is the highlight of this illusionary sense control. It will be the future quest of agriculture. Pigs, cows, chickens, and other animals will not be raised anymore. Instead, they will not be animals, but flesh that has been planted. Only recently, scientists managed to clone a frog without a head, and though it did not survive for more than a week, the enthusiastic expectation is that within a short time we will be able to grow human organs, cows and pigs, without any recognizable quality of life. No more matters of farmers, but productions of plants, of breathing bodies, without a shred of life as we know it, without a shred of ethics. Flesh which cannot die, as it was never really alive in the first place, and yes, this nightmare, as opposed to eternal daylight, will happen. If animals are to be secured from this wretched fate, as it is, they can only hope for the persistence of the xenophobia of human beings, which could be brought about by the fear of having a pig's heart, and maybe growing a pig's tail as a result, and, ironically, this xenophobia could put an end to the xenotransmission for the sake of something truly insensitive, a machine. By no means is this a reason for me to promote machine life. I simply prefer an artificial hearth above an increasingly cruel way animals are being subjected to idiotic experiments. As history should have taught us, it is only one step away from experimenting with people. And with the massive amount of executions in the United States, it might only be a matter of time before prisoners on that row are given a choice to be executed or give up one of their kidneys for transplantation or whatever organ they can spare and stay alive. Illusionary sense control indeed implies the illusionary control over real time, but it might be a good idea to realize that such control remains illusionary. You say that the distance, that absence, today is under threat, mostly as a result of a technical universe of information. I fear, however, that not distance is under threat, neither the absence of things, but the movements of individual bodies. And by movement here I do not mean political movement, but quite literally the capacity of actively moving away from this technical universe of information by, yes, communicating. The facts which you state that digital languages are incapable of allowing us to escape perpetual irradiation of meaning does not prevent us from other means of communication. More importantly, this perceptual irradiation of meaning has been a part of language through its mere existence. The perpetual irradiation of meaning is no more present now than before the age of technical information. It is part of an existential fear of losing control of the status equivalent of the margins of human existence. I do not mean fear of death, but fear of losing status. What is different today is that status and identity have become two absolutely interconnected and interchangeable entities as a result of what we believe to be absolute control, exercised through will, though probably illusionary desire. The myth of this technical universe of information is that you can be whatever you want to be. This myth is simultaneously construction of identity and status, which functions as a precondition for both capitalism and post-capitalism, as it results in a voluntary monetary slavery. I feel this point is important. as otherwise, first of all, difference becomes fully objectified as a status category. And though this might be what structuralism had in mind at one time, it is certainly not what Barthes meant by difference, hence his struggle with structuralism and language. Secondly, it suggests that the subject is continuously under attack by the other. Whenever the distance is diminished, and thereby enforces an individual differentiation which is basically moving towards indifference. And thirdly, it excludes the possibility for a space that allows for activity by individuals. For what may be really true is that I, as an individual body, can feel everything and everybody simultaneously around me, or even inside me, but this does not imply communication, information or control, the myth of understanding, and most certainly it does not imply that I can act on behalf of them others, the myth of democracy. I can only act from myself, for I am limited to my body, and my body is, in the end, the only thing which I am able to move. And that activity only can create the difference. So when you say, now, otherness is that happy distortion without which everybody would simultaneously be me. It is vital illusion of otherness which prevents the ego from succumbing in me. What you actually imply is that the myth of understanding, rationality, and the myth of democracy, representation, can become real. But the other will never be able to be me. For in such a case, understanding would be superfluous. And I will never be the other, for if I could act on his behalf, democracy would also be superfluous. Co-sensing even does not imply co-acting. And as such, what you point out as the role of the modern mass media, for us, an untenable hypothesis, that it may be possible to communicate outside the medium of meaning, that the very intensity of communication may be proportional to the reabsorption of meaning and to its collapse. That is not communication outside the medium of meaning, but a restoration of the Aristotelian unity of action. It explains the success of the soap operas, which believes us to sob over tragedies without having to feel anything. What used to be the catharsis in the Aristotelian drama becomes the replacement for sensing, a further advancement of insensitivity as the unity of action, with its illusionary time, always prevails and dominates over the personal actions of individuals. You are right to observe that nothing in all this engages any responsibility. At no time are the masses politically or historically engaged in a conscious manner. They have only done so out of perversity, in complete irresponsibility. And indeed, none of the guardians of meaning can understand this. The whole morality of the meaning rises up against fascination, as you say, but it equally installs it. I would like to add, and in fact, modern mass media safeguard the distance between the selves and others. The proximity mass media suggests is completely lost by its theatrical display. This theatrical display is not meant to understand the other, nor engage in any activity on part of the individual body. It is meant to unsense and depersonalize every possible activity on part of the individual body by presenting massiveness. The distance or absence is not under threat. It is greater than ever before. It allows us to be absent from any place of action while simultaneously experiencing the simulacrum of intimacy. Now, I do not wish to imply that things are worse than before or that they are better than before. We have no idea, and it is useless quest to seek such comparisons anyway, as any attempt to make such timely construction is bound to be illusionary. but I would like to suggest that in spite of all collapse of meaning, all mass production of meaning, all ordering principles, all status hierarchy, all simulation and illusion, there is a possibility for lucid communication existing, which cannot be captured as it leaves no trace. It can only be sensed through its absolute negation, and as I feel that it has existed alongside life as we know it all along, painfully, it does not speak to us, linguistically. Feeling its existence can only be accomplished by experiencing the ways we deal with sensorium in relation to our linguistic categories. This is what Barthes meant in proposing semiology to be part of linguistics, and not the other way around, like Fernand de Saussure believed. This lucid communication is in fact the perfect crime, because on the one hand it is an absolute proximity of the individual body, but it is also a torment of constant attack, as human beings constantly invent new ways of getting this bitch out in the open, and human beings do so through the everlasting manipulating the body sensorium of individuals through the status of language.